I wrote my very first blog under the name Bonhoeffer Chick. Years later, I used that same name on OkCupid, which is where I met Sean. What can I say? I am an absolute prodigy when it comes to making small choices that throw up massive barriers to entry into my life. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor and theologian. I first encountered his work in a course on contemporary Christian theology. All of the theologians we studied in that course had a remarkable impact on me, both as a Christian and a thinker. But Bonhoeffer, well, he stood out to me. Now, Bonhoeffer's early work is fairly conventional. You might very well find his book, The Cost of Discipleship, on the shelves at any mainline or even moderately conservative church. But his final work, unfinished and published posthumously, is radical. It's radicalizing. Bonhoeffer's final work is a series of letters, essays, and outlines sent to his friends, family, and fiancé while he was locked away in Tegel prison. Oh, yeah, he was in prison. Why? Because he was part of a resistance group in Nazi Germany and conspired with the group to assassinate Hitler. To 20-year-old Tara, Bonhoeffer was a balding, nerdy, wire-rimmed glasses-wearing badass. I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show about rethinking work, business, and leadership as we navigate the 21st century economy. Dietrich Bonhoeffer spent a year and a half inside Tegel prison. He had plenty of time to reflect on the current state of affairs in Germany and the Christian church at large. And he was not impressed. Recognizing the steady march of secularism, Bonhoeffer saw the church as an institution and Christianity as a religion as largely losing its relevance in the world. Observing this, however, he didn't give in to the reactionary impulse. He didn't condemn people for falling away from God or call for a return to a more religious, more pious society. Nor did Bonhoeffer try to preserve some mystical nook for God in a society in which scientific breakthroughs were making the unknown a smaller and smaller place for God to hide out. He wrote to his best friend, Eberhard Benge, in April 1944, saying, "What is bothering me incessantly is the question of what Christianity really is, or indeed who Christ really is for us today." Bonhoeffer observed that God had become a stopgap in modern society. God was found in the margins of knowledge, of experience, of devotion, instead of at the center of life. Instead of pushing science or even secularism away, the question that Bonhoeffer considered incessantly was the question of how to understand God in the midst of modernity, in the midst of advances in science and technology, in the midst of resistance to oppression, oppression often carried out in the name of God. This is the question that's bothered me incessantly for 20 years now. Two, what does it mean to center God within the known material world? What does it mean to put Jesus in the midst of life rather than at its boundaries? Bonhoeffer was trying to imagine the nearly unimaginable, religionless Christianity. And so I've spent the last two decades trying to imagine that too. All right, so now what does any of this have to do with work? Well, quite a lot, actually. Bonhoeffer's stopgap God is everywhere today. Of course, we rarely call it God. If we're contemplating something that leans toward the beyond, we might call it the universe or purpose. But we rely on stopgaps for more mundane things as well. Certainty is intoxicating. In its absence, we fill in the gaps with whatever ideas provide the next fix. Blueprints, formulas, metrics, data analysis. We simplify searching for the security of assurance. Rather than facing down uncertainty, we scramble to form information into the image of our anxiety. We fill in the gaps with new data, new reports, new expertise. We expect that the more knowledge we can gather up, the more likely we are to reach certainty, to know how things work, to solve the problem. But as Nora Bateson writes, the problem with problem solving is the idea that a solution is an endpoint. There are no endpoints in complex systems, only tendrils that diffuse and reorganize situations. The problem with the stopgap god, or the stopgap marketing strategy, or the stopgap revenue stream for that matter, is that it offers a solution, an endpoint. God is on the other end of whatever existential mystery you're contemplating. God is the solution. The marketing strategy is on the other end of your lead generation problem. The marketing strategy is the solution. The revenue stream is on the other end of your income shortfall. The revenue stream is the solution. Or, as systems theorist Danella Meadows observed, the stopgap solution seems to be the key. But to believe so is a mistake. Quote, here in systems analysis, in interconnection and complication, in the power of the computer, here at last is the key to prediction and control. This mistake is likely because the mindset of the industrial world assumes that there is a key to prediction and control. But inevitably, the situation changes. Does the stopgap still fit in the hole that's left? Rarely. When Bonhoeffer noticed that God no longer fit in the tiny hole left for divine mystery, he let God fill up everything that wasn't the hole. God became beyond in our midst. He gave God the chance to be so much bigger simply by letting go of what he thought he knew about God. He asked a different question about God and found a bigger, stranger, and more compelling answer. Now, if there is one thing we can know for sure, it's that the situation will change. Put another way, what works is always a moving target. Even the what and the works are their own variables. When I think about what needs to be done this week, this month, or this year, the options are actually pretty obvious. But what's less obvious are the overlapping contexts and forces within which those options exist. Just as Bonhoeffer's breakthrough happened when he stopped trying to squeeze God into the ever-shrinking hole in human knowledge, there's a breakthrough to be had when we stop trying to squeeze certainty out of uncertainty. The goal of learning, analysis, and strategy doesn't have to be a sure bet. We don't have to resolve uncertainty. In fact, we can't. Not only is the market changing at a breakneck pace, but all of the creative and innovative work we do creates a mess of unknowns. We're not so much finding solutions or even fixing problems as we are adapting in real time. Yet many of us perceive that constant adaptation as aberrant. We believe that some sort of homeostasis is the quote-unquote normal course of things. And so we wait. We wait for things to get back to normal. Or we assume that by making the right moves, we can achieve a more comfortable state of equilibrium. Certainty, it seems, is just beyond our grasp. But it's that longing for certainty that creates the anxiety. If we let uncertainty be normal, we might alleviate the uneasiness that comes from trying to get back to a state that never was. And since uncertainty is normal, we need ways to plot a course in the midst of it. We can't control systems or figure them out, writes Meadows, but we can dance with them. So, how might we navigate uncertainty without trying to resolve it? First, we can ask, what's changed? We can accept that uncertainty is the usual state of things and acknowledge that there are particular clouds of uncertainty that appear more destabilizing or urgent than others. So why do those clouds exist? We're constantly dreaming up, designing, and producing new things. With every new process or strategy, we generate new variables. Organizational researcher Peter Brodner writes, "Hence, companies as well as workers have to permanently cope with new situations, surprise, and uncertainty." I love this insight. It's easy to assume that the cause of uncertainty is external forces outside our control, and that certainly can be the case. But Brodner reminds us that we make the uncertainty we live with, too. Every new article I write, offer I make, or connection I forge introduces the potential for surprise. It's not just happening to me. I produce uncertainty every damn day. So do you. So when there's a particular cloud of uncertainty hanging over our heads, I think the first question we need to ask is, what's changed? Simply laying out the actions we've taken and the decisions we've made, as well as the external factors that contribute to the cloud of uncertainty, helps us get a feel for the contours of the current situation. Next, we ask, what are the knowns and the unknowns? Every cloud of uncertainty is made up of variables. These variables interact in various ways. Some variables are known and others are unknown. All right, hang in there. I'm going to attempt some basic algebra to demonstrate. Imagine the equation A equals B plus C. A equals B plus C. This equation defines the relationship between three variables, A, B, and C. First, A is related to C in that A minus B equals C. Similarly, B is related to C in that A minus C equals B. And while we can continue to tease out the relationships in the formula, we can't know more about these relationships until we identify a known variable. So let's say we make the known variable A. If I say that A equals 5, then I know that B and C could be 2 and 3. Or B and C could be 1 and 4. Or B and C could be 0 and 5. You get the idea. I still don't know for sure what B and C are, but I've narrowed the options, as long as we're willing to stick to integers. Now, if I have two known variables, then there is only one possible answer for the third variable. So if A equals 5 and B equals 1, then C must be 4, right? All right, enough with that algebra example. What I'm trying to say here is that knowing something about a cloud of uncertainty actually helps us out quite a bit. Many of us get swamped trying to know everything before we make a choice or take action. Or we avoid unknown variables altogether. We try to pretend they don't exist. But when we consider both what we know and what we don't know, we get a much better look at what's happening inside our cloud of uncertainty. In fact, letting unknowns exist allows us to consider options we might not have considered before. When both B and C are unknown, there are 6 different combinations of integers that could solve the problem. Each set is just as valid as the next. And the same is true for whatever is happening inside our own clouds of uncertainty. Next, we can ask, what forces are at play? Now, letting things go unknown, that is, unmeasured and unquantified, is a critical part of navigating uncertainty. I find that when there's no label or data point that I can use to sum up a complex phenomenon, it's best to think in terms of force. And to think in terms of force, we're going to have to extend our little algebra problem into the realm of physics. Now, fair warning, I never took physics in college. I didn't take physics in high school. I was much too busy convincing my high school band director to let me do AP music theory as an independent study. But thanks to the power of the internet, I can tell you that a force is a push or pull upon an object resulting from the object's interaction with another object. And it's that push and pull that I'm thinking of when I say force. So let's go back to that algebra problem again. A equals B plus C. Now, if we say that A equals 5 and B tends to be an even number, well, then what can we say about C? We can think of tends to be an even number as a force pulling us in the direction of a certain set of solutions. So now, instead of 6 equally plausible solutions, it's more likely that B equals 0, 2, or 4. Which means it's more likely that C equals 5, 3, or 1. Also, I cannot remember whether 0 actually counts as an even number, and I forgot to look it up before I hit record. So there's that too. In the actual context of your particular cloud of uncertainty, you can think of how the push and pull of trends, economic conditions, budgets, stress levels, holidays, family needs, etc., tend to make certain scenarios more likely than other scenarios. We encounter the push and pull of a dizzying array of forces in absolutely everything we do. For instance, when I publish this episode, I have no idea how it will perform. When I finally hit publish, this episode's relative success will depend on the volume of other podcast episodes hitting subscribers' feeds, the relevance of the subject of this episode, the urgency of other concerns, the popularity of someone else's episode that day, again, etc., etc. I can't attribute the success or lack thereof of this episode to any one of those forces. What results is the product of this episode's interaction with thousands of inboxes and podcast feeds managed by thousands of people all over the world. There's no way to quantify or measure the forces at play, but I can consider how the pushes and pulls might change the results. For whatever might be inside our particular cloud of uncertainty, we examine the forces at play. We don't actually need to know anything to do this. We don't have to wait until we know the magnitude of the force or even what direction it might be pushing or pulling in. Naming the forces helps to acknowledge the uncertainty and naturalize the complexity of a given situation. Of course, it's helpful to get a feel for how a force is likely to act, but we can't do that until we get good at naming what the forces are in the first place. Lastly, we can ask, what is my hypothesis? In a letter dated June 4th, 1944, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote to his friend that the concept of God had become the, quote, working hypothesis to explain what couldn't be explained. Quote, it is becoming evident that everything gets along without God, and in fact, just as well as before. When the question of God is asked narrowly, the answer of God is just a stand-in for some unknown variable that will eventually be knowable. God, he says, is losing more and more ground. Constructing a hypothesis is another aspect of navigating uncertainty. But a hypothesis cannot be a pat answer to a narrowly conceived question. The question, or problem, or mess is always broader, deeper, and more complex than we initially think. And so our hypothesis doesn't describe a solution. It's not an answer. It's how we describe the relationships between variables. It's like the algebra problem we were working on earlier, A equals B plus C. That formula describes the relationships between the three variables, A, B, and C. And having a formula to start with is great. It makes everything easier. However, more often than not, we have to make a formula and then see if it's helpful. And that is forming a hypothesis. When Bonhoeffer says God is a working hypothesis, he's not saying that it's so much a hypothesis as it is just a formula that we're working with. I might express it this way. Knowledge of the world equals scientific knowledge plus God. The way Bonhoeffer saw it, scientific knowledge was an ever-increasing variable, and there was a negative correlation between scientific knowledge and God. That is, the higher the value of scientific knowledge, the lower the value of God. Bonhoeffer argued that the value of scientific knowledge had gotten so high that the value of God was effectively null. So Bonhoeffer needed a different formula. He needed a hypothesis. So he set about trying to make a hypothesis he could prove, or at least demonstrate the usefulness of. In early August 1944, Bonhoeffer came up with this hypothesis. If Jesus is there only for others, and faith is participation in this being of Jesus, then our relation to God is a new life in existence for others. So maybe big G equals big J times P? Okay, that's probably a bit too try hard for even this try hard of a connection. And I have no idea what it would mean to divide God by Jesus or by participation, but hopefully you get the idea. Again, if Jesus is there only for others and faith is participation in this being of Jesus, then our relation to God is a new life in existence for others. So my point here is that navigating uncertainty requires crafting new formulas, hypotheses, and testing them. The first time we state a hypothesis, we can assume it's, at best, not quite right. Over time, we can improve on that hypothesis and make a new one. And that's the real work of navigating uncertainty. In a letter dated August 11th, 1944, Bonhoeffer wrote his final hypothesis to his dear friend, Eberhard. Quote, in the long run, human relationships are the most important thing in life. I don't think Bonhoeffer resolved the uncertainty he felt about the this-worldliness, as he put it, of God. But I think he reached a hypothesis that could act as a map for navigating the uncertainty. On On April 4th, 1944, Hitler gave the order to round up the surviving members of the group that attempted his assassination. Bonhoeffer was transported from Tegel prison to the concentration camp at Flossenbürg. On April 8th, he was sentenced to death. On April 9th, he was hanged. He was just 39 years old. And just 2 weeks later, American troops liberated the camp. I want to close here with another hypothesis, published almost 60 years later. In his book On Religion, philosopher and theologian John Caputo considers, like Bonhoeffer before him, religion without religion. Specifically, he's interested in the love of God. What do I love when I love my God? He asks. Caputo concludes simply that if God is love, then I love love when I love my God. He complicates this beautifully in the conclusion, saying that, quote, love is a how, not a what, and so is God. By this, he means that God isn't something to be known, but rather an action to take, a journey to embark on. Quote, the meaning of God is enacted, or else it is refused, and we devote our time instead to building up our stock portfolios. Continuing, Caputo writes, the meaning of God is enacted in an openness to a future that I can neither master nor see coming, in an exposure to possibilities that are impossible for me, which surpass my powers, which overpower me, which drive me to the limits of the possible, which draw me out to God. There is far more meaning to be had in navigating uncertainty than in trying to resolve it. No stopgap needed. What Works is a reader and listener-supported media venture. Premium subscribers help make deep dive analysis about work, leadership, business, and economics sustainable. If you love What Works and you have the means, I'd love to have your support too. For just $7 per month, you'll get access to premium content and quarterly live workshops. Go to whatworks.fyi to learn more. That's whatworks.fyi. Every episode of What Works is also published in essay form on Substack. Go to whatworks.fyi to find this week's essay, plus a whole archive of in-depth reporting and analysis on the future of work. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.